Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Clinicians in Leadership podcast series put on by the American Journal of Healthcare Strategy. This podcast series is specifically focused on clinicians in leadership, specifically focused on empowering clinicians from the bedside to the boardroom. Today, we have the unique opportunity to welcome a very special guest, Mr. Travis Kaufman. Travis Kaufman has a wealth of experience, not just in a clinical setting, but also in the leadership setting. Travis, do you mind taking a second to introduce yourself and just telling us a little bit about your experience?
Hey, Zach. Thanks a lot for having me on, and I really appreciate being on the American Journal of Healthcare Strategies podcast. I'm super excited to be here. Just a little bit about me, about my background. I've been a PA now for about 12 years. I currently am an active duty PA. I had the pleasure to serve in the combat environment, deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, as well as Inherent Resolve. And then prior after the serving in that realm, I was able to serve at the White House Medical Unit for 5 years, where I worked as the Chief Medical Operations Officer and the lead PA. And it was kind of interesting because I got to work under three presidential administrations, including Presidents Obama, President Trump, and President Biden. So thinking about those times, I was able to work as the COVID coordinator throughout that. We supported many operations. I believe we traveled to 43 countries, and I supported 452 CONUS missions supporting president and vice president travel. And I've been fortunate to take that experience. And over the last 3 years, I've worked as a medical advisor in 17 different countries of NATO, North American Treaty Organization. And I've advised about 32 nations on emergency preparedness and disaster medicine situations to make sure that if something does happen in a combat environment or disaster situation, we can all work together. And in addition to that, I teach at the University of Lynchburg's Doctor of Medical Science program, and I lead the emergency management and global health concentration. Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, if that resume doesn't excite you just to hear from just this wealth of experience and knowledge, I'm not sure what will. So, Travis, I can't imagine more experiences that require emergency preparedness than working at the White House, serving in the military, and doing so, especially over the course of COVID. So, Just for our listeners, can you tell us just a little bit about why emergency preparedness is so critical for healthcare organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. So really, the biggest thing when you think about the importance of emergency preparedness for healthcare organizations, you really want to think about the safety and welfare of your patients, right? That's your number one, the safety and welfare of your patients. And then you think about your staff. I mean, your staff are going to support taking care of those patients. And then also the community during crisis. And, you know, we've seen that recently with the hurricanes that's happened in North Carolina and Florida. And we have to think about a wide range of emergencies, including natural disasters, like I talked about the hurricanes. And of course, the pandemic that just we really just lived through everybody. And unfortunately, you know, we're seeing this a little bit more in America as mass casualty events. And that's when we're thinking about those active shooter drills. So that's really why it's so important for organizations to be prepared. And when we talk about preparedness, we want to talk about mitigating risks, minimizing disruptions to care, right? So if a hurricane does strike that hospital, has that hospital made a plan to have a backup generator so the ICU can keep running and taking care of those patients, right? That's something they have to think about. That critical infrastructure, right? So I can tell you just from experience, I had the pleasure and the opportunity to work with the White House, and we responded after Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Irma in Puerto Rico. And, you know, it was really the infrastructure of the hospitals was devastated. Really is no way to prepare for that. And one thing we noticed is when they brought their ambulances that, you know, when you bring your ambulance in that area, it was all destroyed. There was no safe way to bring patients into the emergency room. But really they had thought forward and thought ahead, and they also worked with FEMA. And they had brought in tents, and they had actually brought in bulldozers and really cleared a path so they could bring emergency vehicles in to take care of those patients. And that was a really thoughtful way to do that. So that's really the biggest thing is why that's so important when it's talking about the infrastructure. But then we think about things inside the hospital, like blood storage, right? And we think about it from a hospital situation, you know, there's a lot more rules and regulations of storing blood. How do you get the blood? But then we also think about that from a more austere combat environment. So in, you know, a more austere combat environment, we talk about blood drives. We actually will, before deploying, we will cross match and check every soldier that deploys. And that way, if there is a mass casualty event on a military base, or say it's a disaster situation and we're taking care of the local population, we can call all those designated donors and bring them in and plus up our blood supply to take care of those traumas. So that's kind of when you're looking at the infrastructure versus what's also going on inside. And then lastly, we think about personnel, right? Because that's our best asset. We can have all the great equipment. We can have all the great, you know, plans. But if we don't have the personnel to really back us up, so we really have to make sure that we look at our shift work, our sleep rest cycles. Those are things important to have your personnel ready to go in case that does happen. So that's kind of everything together to be prepared.
Well, and I think about, I mean, no one, to my knowledge, enjoys going to a hospital on a normal day. I can't imagine during a mass casualty event or some sort of emergency setting, your entire world has been rocked. You are looking for stability. And if the place where you are going to look for that stability is not providing that stability, then everything else is crumbling. And so, I think that answer was really helpful. So what role, we're talking about emergency preparedness and just the ways that healthcare facilities can be prepared for emergencies. What role does leadership specifically play into making sure that those healthcare facilities are prepared?
So, you know, the biggest thing is having a culture of preparedness, right? When we're thinking about preparedness, it's the leader has to get in the front and say, hey, this is how we're going to do it. And that's not barking orders. That's talking about really prioritizing emergency preparedness and strategic planning, also allocating resources, training and drills, and also fostering collaboration among departments, right? So it really starts right there at the leadership. And you also have to watch out for timing because everyone's, you know, working in the ER, they're being very busy. The ICU is very busy. So really what you do is when you're doing those huddles in the morning, you could talk about an example of saying, hey, you know, we have a hurricane, if it's in Florida, you know, we have a hurricane coming to the area. This is how we're going to prepare. And you could just do a quick little drill. It could just be a quick 15-minute drill saying, hey, we have a mass casualty event. Let's test out our radios real quick. Let's go out into the parking lot, make sure our triage stations are up to par. And then let's go ahead and call the ICU. Let's go ahead and call the blood bank. Let's go ahead and call general surgery and say, hey, we're just testing out these systems. So in case this does happen, everybody's ready to go and we're all talking, right? Because I'm going to be 100% honest with you. When things get really kind of crazy, the first thing to go down is communication. Communication is the first thing to go down. And when we think communication, we're always thinking, okay, maybe we're sending something through a digital system. Possibly we are calling by radio or maybe our phone system, right? So it's really up to the leader to build that culture of preparedness right up front, make sure that it's important. That's what's going to be big. But also, when you're talking with staff, you can ask them, you know, why don't we go ahead and set up some annual, biannual, or quarterly drills, right? So say you're in an urban hospital, it's a level one trauma center, and you have a mass decon area. Or, you know, most of those hospitals have a mass decontamination area that's going to be in their ambulance bay, but they're also going to have a small decontamination area. And you'll say, I think that we should probably really work this out and do a drill quarterly. And if you establish that culture where you come in, you work that quarterly, then everybody's familiar with that decon system. So in case something does happen, you're ready to go, right? And that can also be triage and mass casualty events. Say, let's look at this quarterly. Let's just work on our mass casualty incidents and make sure that we know what we're doing. And just bring some ambulances through, practice taking patients off, how you're going to communicate that, you know, because you've seen a really busy ER. There's patients in hallways. The, you know, the trauma room can be full. So how are we going to really put these patients and store them and make sure that they are getting taken care of and not forgotten? So that's you know, all together, that's what leadership has to do, is really put that up front and just keep a culture of preparedness.
Well, and you just, the couple things you mentioned just stood out to me. I mean, the one, just the importance of drills and practicing, because the first time that you are a healthcare organization is enacting these protocols should not be when an emergency is happening. Your staff should just resort to the training that they have received, and that training is led and guided by that leadership. And the other thing that stood out to me is just the importance of communication, and how, I mean, we've heard a lot, communication is that is one of the key components of just leadership across the board. If you can't communicate, you cannot be an effective leader. And so just the way that communication can break down during emergency settings, contrasting that with just the importance of leadership, building that culture of preparedness. I love that term. Love the way you described that. And also just building that culture of communication is fantastic.
And Zach, you bring me back to a really important too about leadership. It's also taking feedback from your subordinates and your peers, right? So when you do those drills, they're great and important, but if you don't accept the feedback and the after action reviews, then you can't improve, right? So I can give you a great example. We're working out of an ambulance. We're getting ready for the inauguration of the president, and we're working out of the back of this ambulance, and we're working out of our bags. And we notice it's getting kind of messy in the back of the ambulance as we're practicing. So, you know, when we thought about how to improve, we're like, okay, let's put together a system on the walls of the ambulance to make this care and improve it. And we feed that to our leadership to make sure that it could get approved and happened. And our leadership listened to us, and we made it better. So that was just an example of how my leaders listened to me. And it was good for me as I progressed as a leader to make that better.
That's fantastic. So talking emergency preparedness, emergencies don't happen every day. And that'd be terrible if they did, but they don't happen every day. And just the nature that they don't happen every day is what catches everybody off guard. And so how does a healthcare organization balance your day-to-day operations while maintaining this readiness for emergencies?
Yeah, that's a tough one, right? Because everyone's doing their work day, they're getting after it. So I think, as going back to those drills, establishing that culture, another thing to look at is we really need to prioritize resource allocation, right? So when you're thinking about resource allocation, you're thinking about, okay, let's look at COVID, for example. COVID kind of hit us all. We were back on our heels. We weren't ready. And I think that was really a great example to show us we need to keep things in more of a strategic reserve in our healthcare system. And that could be all the way at the hospital, and that could be on an ambulance, right? So if we make sure they have resource allocation appropriate for both everyday operations, but also those emergency preparedness operations. So if we know that we're going to have a mass casualty event, you should probably have some trauma bags ready to go. That you can pull out the trauma bag. It's got all your triage tools in it. If you've got a decontamination bag or a box that you can just pull out and it's ready to go. Now with that, it's great to have all that, but you do have to make sure that it gets inventoried, right? Because if you haven't looked at it in a year and you pull it out and there's cobwebs and things are falling apart, obviously that's an issue. So I think establishing kind of a clear schedule for training and preparation, inspecting that equipment, that goes back to those quarterly drills, but also make someone responsible, right? So within our hospitals, we have, you know, your emergency management person. You know, we're talking with PAs, we're talking with doctors and nurses. Maybe if you're the lead APP, you have a couple APPs with you that say, hey, you're gonna be in charge of the emergency management for this department. Let's put together these systems and let's educate everybody. So that's kind of how you have to manage it to make sure everybody's on board, but also able to do their day-to-day tasks.
Well, and just thinking about what we've talked about so far, the I mean, responding to an emergent situation, it should never be a one man or one woman show. It is requires intense coordination and communication. And I loved what you mentioned at the end, how a leader empowers other leaders to mm-hmm. assist in the overall unified goal, which in this case would be responding to whatever that emergency situation and yeah. ensuring that you're prepared for those situations. One of the things you mentioned that I thought was interesting, you mentioned resource allocation. And so we have a very, and I'm sure you have very practical applications for this, having been serving in the White House over the COVID pandemic. But how does an organization approach balancing resource allocation when demands exceed your capacity?
You know, that's a really tough one, right? So, and that's really where we talk about the term triage, and everyone's like, yeah, we got triage. But when we think about really like real live serious triage in an emergent situation, that's when we sometimes have to make those hard decisions, right? So if you say you have 25 casualties that come to your door, right? And you know that you only have so much blood, you only have one neurosurgeon, there's going to be some triage that's going to come into play. And sometimes you have to keep those patients comfortable, but you have to know that this patient and their injuries, it may not be compatible with life. This could be, especially if you're working in that disaster medicine scenario and you're in a tent, you're in a hurricane stricken environment, and you've only got so many supplies, right? So that is where that's triage, but you can also look at your evacuation systems too. And this goes back to the communication and that resource allocation. So if you know that you're about to receive all these patients, this is where collaboration with other entities really, really comes into play. And this could be other hospital systems in the community. This could be the local EMS. This could be the firefighters. And this really is when it really is important for community involvement. And when I say community involvement, that means know all your local firefighters. And you know, this could go to, you know, you as the APP and you have a lot of experience in emergency medicine. Maybe you go to that fire department and you give them some stop to bleed, some tactical combat casualty care training. You go to the local EMS and you volunteer with them some time. You talk with the local community, you do that stop the bleed training. That's where that community buy-in all comes together. So if this happens, you may not have to make those hard decisions and triage because the community comes together. You can collaborate with other entities and other hospital systems if that's who you're working with. When it's a disaster situation, you may have other nonprofits that you know have the resources that you can say, hey, I can get this patient to you or can you get this patient to me, right? We do that in the military all the time. You know, we're thinking about helicopters and forward light ambulances and how are we going to allocate it? We're not going to send a helicopter to every patient, right? So that's really when that's important, but that comes with allocation, community buy-in right up front before it happens.
So just recognizing you have a wealth of experience in a wide variety of settings, both from the clinical side and the administrative leadership side, how do you feel as if your clinical experience has helped your leadership or administrative, has helped in those leadership or administrative roles?
Well, you know, one thing I can really tell you about, like all the clinicians, and I think for us is our brains sometimes, I think our brains work a little bit different than most regular people, right? So as we're getting trained as clinicians, you know, we're talking to our patient, we're getting that history and physical, right? We're already thinking about our differential diagnosis. That's really helped me a lot in leadership, right? So when I'm thinking through those problems, I'm really listening to the local community, or I'm really looking at the situation and I'm saying, okay, I hear you. And I'm extrapolating those really important details, just like a patient, right? Patient's going to give you a couple details that you're like, that's really important for the diagnosis. But also it's that human touch as well, right? So we don't just have a patient. We don't have that broken leg right in front of us. That's Mrs. Sally with the broken hip, right? Or, you know, that's Joe with the heart condition. So that's how we also have to approach it, from that human touch as well. And that's really helped me with leadership. when I'm talking with people, I really want to hear them and see them and let them know that I feel what they're telling me, and I want to do the best for them to make sure we can, you know, do the best for the patients, the community, however we're working. That's something that's really helped me in the long run as a clinician, kind of bringing that empathetic brain and that problem solving to help me in leadership.
So there's a lot of different ways organizations and leaders can be prepared for emergency situations. What are some technological innovations either that you have used in the field in an emergency setting, whether that's in the military or the White House, just some technological innovations or technologies that help improve emergency preparedness?
Oh gosh, yeah, that's a great one. I mean, technology, it's hard for us to keep up, right? I mean, look at us with artificial intelligence right now. Yeah. I say one of the most important things is real-time communication systems, right? So like I said, the first thing to go down is comms. So really look at those communication systems. And when I'm saying that, you know, we're looking at radios. And I'm going to tell you, we worked with the Ukraine refugees when I was in Romania. And I had a colleague that worked with some of the Afghanistan refugees when she was in Kuwait. And I tell you what, we're really adopting Starlink. Starlink is one of those technologies where you're having that internet right there real time, and it really helps you with communication. So that's a technology that I really got on board with, and it's really helping us out, because I may not necessarily be able to call you on a radio or call you on the cell phone, because some of those areas we've worked in, if you put off a heat signature, you do put yourself out there to possibly be a casualty from a bombing or something like that, right? With the Starlink, you can kind of keep a smaller signature and you can send messages through the computer, right? That's something I really adopted recently, and I think it's great. And you saw recently in the hurricane, Starlink was being used. So those are really some great communication systems that, and emergency systems, I think really have to adopt, right? Those are big ones. And that takes me to telemedicine. You know, you can pull up your phone, and, you know, overseas we use the WhatsApp or we use Signal. Sometimes we call on the phone, but there's also telemedicine that you can pull up. You know, me as a PA, if I know I have a really, really critical patient and I'm about to do a chest tube or I'm about to do a surgical procedure that is life-saving, but it's very high risk, telemedicine is really great. I can get that surgeon on the line, talk me through it, or make a recommendation against it. That's something I've used quite a bit in my practice. That's really, really helped in some of those really austere situations. So the communication, telemedicine, and then a big one is data analytics. And this one is one, it's not one of those super sexy ones, but, you know, after COVID, you know, we've had Hurricane Katrina. We've really had time to go back and look at those data analytics. And they really help us predict and prepare for patient issues based on historical data. So if you're not looking at that data to be prepared, you're working with one hand tied behind your back, okay? But you also use that, I take it back to allocating resource. If that data shows you this is how we should have allocated these resources, that's something you have to do, right? And then lastly, we're looking at these mobile health applications. And when we're saying mobile health, I've seen it when I've worked in Israel. They have an EMT basic on a motorcycle, and they will go out and respond on their motorcycle first. And then usually you can bring in the doctor that's going to be on the ambulance. But with that, you know, when you got some of those really congested cities, that's something really important to think about. And that's a mobile health application. You've really got that life-saving entity there really fast, and the patient's not waiting. I'm going to tell you, the future looks really awesome. And we're seeing this a lot on the battlefield in Ukraine. We're talking about drones, right? We're seeing drones bringing whole blood to patients, drones able to evacuate patients off the battlefield. So really adapting to the drones and looking at that, I think that's going to be the wave of the future to really help us out in healthcare. So those are some really forward-thinking ideas and things that we have right now.
Well, that's fascinating. All the technology you mentioned, the drones has always been fascinating. That's just a component that has really taken off in the last couple of years. But that Israel's usage of EMTs on motorcycles is just that. What a fantastic idea.
Right. Yeah.
Not only just from the perspective of getting care to the patient right away, but also to the perspective of when those advanced providers show up on scene, they have someone who is aware of the situation more so. So they are not coming in totally blind and deaf, but rather they are coming into a scene that is maybe a little bit more controlled, or at least there's been an initial assessment made. And so you're able to initiate some of those more life-saving interventions quicker. And so, that's awesome. So as we start to wrap up, just one of the final questions I had for you is just as you are looking ahead towards the future, what are some emerging threats that healthcare organizations should prepare for, and how can they stay ahead of those threats?
Yeah, that's a great one. And that goes back to that data analytics, always looking at your data and seeing what's going on. You know, we're always looking at these pandemics and these infectious disease outbreaks. I think COVID really reminded us that's an issue. So I think that's something that we always stay on top of. We really look at it, and we're looking at the data that's going on. Like recently I've seen an uptick of pertussis, and that's kind of an interesting one that you can see. When you're looking at kind of global health over in Africa, actually, because they have the PrEP therapy that's so good for HIV, they're actually seeing a rise in sexually transmitted infections because the local population thinks it's safe to have unprotected sex. And you're seeing a rise in STIs because PrEP is so good. So that just comes down to education, but that's one of those pandemics we really have to look after. And that's in a global environment, right? Another big one is cybersecurity threats. I think that's really a big one. Healthcare people, we probably don't always think about it. And our cyber people are like, hey, look out for those phishing emails. You know, we got to do our annual training, but we're like, yeah, but that's a big deal, right? So, because healthcare systems, we rely on the electronic medical record. I mean, how many hospital systems have you seen if that goes down, we might not be able to see patients. So also like really, really looking at our roots so that we can still make orders on paper and work that way if we need to, but also having a backup if that cybersecurity issue comes up. And then climate related disasters. You know, climate's always a big one for everybody. We've seen the hurricanes recently. And with those hurricanes, you know, in North Carolina, we had flooding. So it's one thing to have the hurricane come through, destroy some systems. We've been really good about evacuating people and getting our systems back up and running. But when there's a flood, with the flooding comes a lot of other things. That more disease, more infections come with that. So really thinking about those climate-related disasters. I can tell you, earlier this year, I worked in the Dominican Republic, and they had a major hurricane several years ago. And there's this whole displaced population in San Cristobal, Dominican Republic, where they all live in kind of like the metal shacks. You know, the houses are made out of wood, just because the infrastructure wasn't there. The hospital system is still trying to catch up. So, you know, I think from a global perspective is really look at those climate disasters and how we can help with that as well. And then lastly, you know, this is the one that we all hate to talk about, but we know it happens. That's those mass casualty incidents. And that's those active shooters, you know, how to be prepared for those. And that's, you know, we're training our children in schools, which is unfortunate, but that's what we have to do. But also having those local hospital systems. And that's where that collaboration with the EMS, the firefighters, you know, the police officers, you know, something as simple as a, you know, usually the police officers are the first one to be there, right? Or your firefighters, something as simple as throwing on a tourniquet, that saves a life. And or just your general population, you know, a mom that's going to pick up kids and they're in this situation. If she knows how to put on a tourniquet, if there's, you know, because we're already doing AEDs on walls, stop the bleed is so important. So I think that's really emerging threats that we really have to watch out for.
Well, thank you, Travis, for joining us today on the Clinicians in Leadership podcast series hosted by the American Journal of Healthcare Strategy. I know I personally have benefited from just this conversation with you, and I can trust that our listeners have as well. So grateful for your experience and your oversight and the different ways that you have served. And thank you again for your service for our country. We greatly appreciate it.
Great, Zach. Thanks for your time.